Hello, this is Kyle Jones, your speaker for this evening. Tonight, we will cover the idea of evil, personified from three great periods of English culture. Our agenda is to expose the movements of evil as an idea versus the reality of evil as its nature shows, where figurative and literal depart and where they meet. Ultimately, how does the biblical evil compare with that of an entirely different culture's sense of evil as personified and allegorical? Another way to say this is, we will look at the idea of what people held as evil or temptation in the workings of Old English contextual writings and compare these writings to that of what the Bible deems as evil. The first agenda is to establish the language and culture of these writings. The second agenda is to capture the early writers' efforts to convey this idea of cultural evil to the reader by its personification via literature in contrast to that of the biblical Satan. The third agenda is to see what is conveyed as good, that evil may destroy the things established as good within the literary contexts. Fourthly, to see what holds the people together in the story when evil strikes. And finally, to explain that evil is a reality, that it does exist. It is monstrous, and evil is not a childish concoction. Number one, the language and culture of these collected writings can be broken down into three great periods. The first is the Old English or Anglo-Saxon language and its period. The writings of the epic Beowulf will be our main focus of this era. This period was called the period of the full inflection. That is, when the English language had a full array of changes placed at the end of their words, it was capable of expressing differentiation of the same root word by this device. This era existed from 449 AD to 1150, which is about 150 years after the Norman invasion. Such examples of this era can be seen for us in our exemplary word for mouth, from where we get our modern word for mouth. Mouth is regulated by its case endings, ending to the nominative case. Nominative means naming the thing in its basic form. Secondly, mouthes is in the genitive, meaning of the mouth. Thirdly, the dative mouthe, or mouthe, conveying to the mouth. Fourthly, the accusative mouth, in which the inflection designates a calling out to the mouth. And fifthly, the instrumental case for our modern mouth, called mouth, which expresses with or by means of the mouth. There is also the plural, which I hope you get the point. Number two, the second of these great three languages and their correlative culture was called the Middle English. This period is called the period of the leveled inflections, in which case the dominant vowel of the case endings or inflections is the letter E, which can be seen in Sir Gawain and the Green Knight. Examples also, as well as that, can be seen in Chaucer and Wycliffe from the 1300s to 1400s AD. Such examples are follows: stones, carre, wille, binden, or binden, bende, and helpeth. Each of these is found to be disyllabic or simply two-syllabled, as seen in the earlier Anglo-Saxon. Third, this third period is in correlative culture is the modern English period. This period is called the period of the lost inflections. This period extends from 1500 AD to present. It is the language of Thomas Marlowe, the Geneva Bible, Edmund Spenser, Shakespeare, John Milton, following to the Renaissance, Victorian, and in my opinion, the literary declinative Industrial Revolution era to modern American. Tonight, we will be focusing heavily, intensely, on the story called Sir Gawain and the Green Knight. This is roughly put together around 1400 AD, drawing on many Celtic pagan myths and Germanic myths. This goes back to the Greenery cult, as C.S. Lewis said. All Arthurian romances and romances stemming out of the Arthurian epic were based in Greenery cult. Tonight, we're going to look at the druidical formulaic cycle based on the Yule wheel, or the wheel of the passings of the seasons, their colors, and the tree branches of all trees that associate with the passings of these seasons, as even which the word druid, darut, means literally the tree seers, or the seers that are in the trees, where we also get the word for truth, root, stem, and branches. Of the tree alphabet, we have an acronym called the Beth Lewis Nelson Tree Alphabet, first compiled and put together, seen by Roderick O'Flaherty's Ogygia. We have the Beth, which is symboled as B, if you will, the acrophonic, or the acronym, excuse me, for the tree birch. Lewis, L for Rowan, Nian for N or ash, fern, F for alder, wood, sail, the S letter for willow, uath, H for hawthorn, dur, D for oak, where we get word drua, teen or tine, ta or the T for holly, coal, C for hazel, muin, M for vine, gort, G for ivy, pethbach, P for dwarf elder, ruas, R for elder, alm, A or A for silver fir, on O, the letter O for furs, or which is a U for heather, Ada, E for white poplar, and Ido or Ato for I, the letter I for U. As Robert Graves states in his White Goddess on page 165, he says, quote, "I noticed almost at once that the consonants of this alphabet form a calendar of seasonal tree magic, and all the trees figure prominently in European folklore." In this druidical seasonal tree magic formula, we have what we call the tree alphabet again, where these two trees to be focused on are the oak and the holly, symbolized by the letter, the Welsh letter D, dor, and the tine, the T. These two trees will be formulaic within the story of the Green Knight and Gawain, Sir Gawain, and how they act. This is a formula that goes back as far as time immemorial. Before we start the story in our reading of Sir Gawain and the Green Knight, I want to give a definition of the characteristic for the tree, the branch tree of the cycle, the Celtic cycle, namely that T for tine. I'm going to read out of Dr. Robert Graves' book, The White Goddess, for this one, to establish the characteristics of this green knight as tree, as formula. The eighth tree on this wheel, this cycle of seasonal magics, is the holly, which flowers in July. The holly appears in the originally Irish romance of Gawain and the Green Knight. The Green Knight is an immortal giant whose club is a holly bush. He and Sir Gawain, who appears in the Irish version of the Cuchulainn, a typical Hercules, make a compact to behead one another at alternate New Year's, meaning midsummer and midwinter. But in effect, the holly knight spares the oak knight. In Sir Gawain's Marriage, a Robin Hood ballad, King Arthur, who there has a seat at Carlisle, says, quote, "As I came over a moor, I see a lady where she sat, between an oak and a green holland. She was clad in red scarlet." This lady, whose name is not mentioned, will have been the goddess of Cridalad, for whom, in Welsh myth, the oak knight and holly knight fought every 1st of May until Doomsday. Since in medieval practice, St. John the Baptist, who lost his head on St. John's Day, took over the Oak King's titles and customs, it was natural to let Jesus, as John's merciful successor, take over the Holly King's. The holly was thus glorified beyond the oak. For example, in the Holly Tree Carol, quote, "Of all the trees that are in the wood, the holly bears the crown," end quote. a sentiment that derives from the song of the forest trees. Quote, of all trees whatsoever the critically, best is holly. In each stanza of the carol, with its apt chorus about, quote, the rising of the sun, the running of the deer, end quote, some property of the tree is equated with the birth or passion of Jesus. The whiteness of the flower, the redness of the berry, the sharpness of the prickles, the bitterness of the bark. Holly means holy. Yet the holly, which is native to the British Isles, is unlikely to be the original tree of the alphabet. It has probably displaced the evergreen scarlet oak, with which it has much in common, including the same botanical name, ilex, and which was not introduced into the British Isles until the 16th century. The scarlet oak, or currum oak, or holly oak, is the evergreen twin of the ordinary oak, and its classical Greek names, prinos and hyssege, are also used for holly in modern Greek. It has prickly leaves and nourishes the curm, a scarlet insect not unlike the holly berry, and once thought to be a berry, from which the ancients made their royal scarlet dye and an aphrodisiac elixir. In the authorized version of the Bible, the word oak is sometimes translated terebinth, and sometimes scarlet oak, and these trees make a sacred pair in the Palestinian region. Jesus wore curm scarlet when attired as king of the Jews. See Matthew 27, verse 28. We may regard the letters D and T as twins. The lily white boys clothed all in green O. Of the medieval Green Rushes song, this was quoted. D is the oak which rules the waxing part of the year, the sacred druidic oak, the oak of the golden bough. T is the evergreen oak which rules the waning part, the bloody oak. Thus, an evergreen oak grove near the Corinthian Asopus was sacred to the Furies, which is the Fays, the demons, the women of the field, the Fortunae, the little darting demons in the feminine form. Dan or tan, the equivalent of tine or teen, is a Celtic word for any sacred tree. In Gaul and Brittany, it meant oak. In Celtic Germany, it meant fir. In Cornwall, the compound glaston, green sacred tree, this was what it means, meant evergreen holm oak. And the English word to tan comes from the, comes from the use of its bark in tanning. However, in ancient Italy, it was the holly, not the evergreen oak, which the husbandmen used in their midwinter Saturnalia. Tanis was the name of the Gaulish thunder god, and Tina, that of the thunder god, armed with a triple thunderbolt, whom the Etruscans took over from the Goidelic tribes among whom they settled. The identification of the pacific or passive Jesus with the holly or holly oak must be regretted as poetically inept, except insofar as he declared that he had come to bring not peace but the sword. The tannist was originally his twin's executioner. It was the oak king, not the holly king, who was crucified on a T-shaped cross. Lucian, in his, quote, trial in the court of vowels about 160 A.D., is explicit, as said, quote, men weep and bewail their lot and curse Cadmus with many curses for introducing tau into the family of letters. They said it was his body that tyrants took for a model, his shape that they imitated when they set up the erections on which men are crucified. Staros, this is the Greek word for the word cross, the vile engine is called, and it derives its vile name from him. Now, this is coming from a pagan Roman here. Now with all these crimes upon him, does he not deserve death? Nay, many deaths. For my part, I know none bad enough but that supplied by his own shape, that shape which he gave to the gibbet, named Staros after him by men. Now this is a quote of indictment of a man, a Roman, a pagan Roman, against Christ, but showing what he was to be, was crucified on. It was not the tau, it was the staros. And we have another quote, and I won't go too much further than this because I don't hold this to be potency. But in it, quote again with Robert Graves, and in a Gnostic Gospel of Thomas, composed about the same date, the same theme recurs in a dispute between Jesus and his schoolmaster about the letter T. The schoolmaster strikes Jesus on the head and prophesies the crucifixion. In Jesus' time, the Hebrew character tau, the last letter of the alphabet, was shaped like the Greek tau. The holy rules the eighth month, and eight as the number of increase is well suited to the month of the barley harvest, which extends from July 8th to August 4th. If one believes that this information that I just read was too extraneous, one can please forgive me, for I found that this information to be very pertinent concerning reading the text of Sir Gawain and the Green Knight, which I am going to do right now. Chapter 1, verse 1 and following. Since the siege and the assault upon Troy were finished, the city destroyed and burned down to embers and ashes. And the man who made the decoys that deceived them was tried for his treachery, though no man on earth was more true. It was the noble Aeneas and his high-born kin who came to conquer provinces and become the lords of almost all the wealth of the Western Isles. Noble Romulus went to Rome at once. Proudly he set up that city at the beginning, giving it his own name, which it bears to this day, Ticius to Tuscany, to begin building there. Longobard builds high houses in Lombardy, and far across the flood from France, Felix Brutus is happy to settle the many hills and the whole breadth of Britain. And here we go, where war and woe and wonder have been known frequently, and by turns bliss and despair have changed places suddenly. And when this Britain was built by this noble knight, bold men were bred in it who loved fighting, and they made trouble in the course of time. More marvels have happened often in this land than in any other I know since that first age. But of all who lived here as kings of Britain, Arthur was ever the noblest, as I have heard tell. So I intend to tell of one adventure that happened, which some have considered a marvel to behold, one of the wonders that are told about Arthur. If you will listen for a little while to my lay, I shall tell it as I heard it in the hall, aloud, as it is set down in a strong story with true letters written together in the old way. This king was staying at Camelot at Christmas time, with many fair lords and the most beautiful ladies and the whole high brotherhood of the Round Table, in happy festivity and on the high revels of the season. The men charged in tournaments again and again, noble knights jousting in high spirits. Then they rode to the court and danced to carols. And the feast went on like that of full 15 days, with all the food and entertainment anyone could imagine. The laughter and merrymaking were a glory to hear, a happy din all day and dancing at night, all on a high note in halls and chambers, with lords and ladies as they liked it best. They stayed there together with all the wealth in the world, the most famous knights under Christ himself, and the most beautiful ladies who ever lived, and the finest of all was the king holding the court, all of these fair folk there in the hall, in their first age. The most fortunate under heaven, the highest king, famous for his will. Now it would be hard for anyone to name such a brave host on any hill. When the year had turned, knew only the night before, the company that day was served double at the high table, when the king and his knights came into the hall. The chanting in the chapel had come to an end, and a loud cry went up from the clerics and the others, proclaiming Noel once more, calling out the word again. And then the nobles ran and got the gifts ready, called out the New Year's presents, holding them high. And they debated back and forth over the gifts. The ladies laughed loudly, all the ones who had lost, And the winner was not so sorry, you can be sure. All this celebration went on until dinner time. When they had washed well, they went to sit at the table, the most famous knights nearest the top, as was proper, and Guinevere, in high spirits, was seated in the middle of them, in the arrangement of the famous table, with them arrayed around her, fine silk, furthermore, in a canopy over her, of Toilhouse red, and many Tharsian tapestries, embroidered and set with the finest of jewels. That would have cost a great deal if someone had tried to buy them. The most beautiful there was the queen, flashing her gray eye. No one had ever seen anyone lovelier in his day. Yet Arthur would not eat until they were all served. He seemed full of joy, of youth, almost a boy. He was happy with his life. He cared little for lying in bed or sitting still for a long time. His young blood so stirred him and his wild brain. And there was a custom, besides, that he meant to keep, that he had assumed in his noble way he would not eat on such a holiday until he had been told a tale all new of some wonderful event, of some great marvel that he might believe, about kings or arms or other adventures, or unless someone came to ask for a proven knight to join with him in jousting, putting his life in peril, risking life against life, each of them allowing fortune to grant the advantage to one of them. This was the king's custom when he was holding court, at every great feast with his noble company in the castle. So with his proud face there bravely he stands waiting, bold in that new year, and joins in the merrymaking. So the king, in his strength, was standing there by himself, talking of court trifles to those at the high table. There sat good Gawain, with Guinevere beside him, and Agravaine, of the hard hand, on the other side of her. Both of them, the king's nephews and famous knights, Bishop Baudouin, was up at the head of the table, and then Ewain beside him, who was the son of Urien. These were seated on the dais, or the raised platform, and lavishly served, and many renowned knights were near them at the side tables. Then came the first course, to the blaring of trumpets, with many brilliant banners hanging from them. New kettle drums rumbled, with the noble pipes wakening wild warblings with their loud sounds, and lifting many hearts high with their music. In the midst of it, rare and delicate dishes were served, mounds of fresh meat, and so many platters that it was hard to find enough places to set down the silver with its stews in it on the tablecloth. Each one, as he pleases, takes whatever he will. For every two there are 12 dishes, good beer and bright wine both. Now I will say no more about their service, for all must know that no one lacked anything. Another noise and a new one suddenly reached them in less time than it takes to lift food to the lips. And here we go. Scarcely had the sound faded away again with the first course in the court properly served, then in at the hall door comes in a frightening figure. He must have been taller than anyone in the world, from the neck to the waist so huge and thick, and his loins and limbs so long and massive, that I would say he was half a giant on the earth. At least I am sure he was the biggest of men, yet he sat with a matchless grace in the saddle. His back and his chest and whole body were frightening, and both his belt and belly were trim and small, and all of his features were in proportion to the rest of him. But more than anything, his color amazed them, a bold knight riding, the whole of him bright green. And all in green, this knight in his garments, with a close-fitting coat that clung to his side, a fine robe over it adorned on the inside, with furs cut to one color, an elegant lining, trimmed brightly with white fur, and his hood also, that was caught back from his long locks and lay on his shoulders. Neat, tight-tailored, hose of that same green, clung fast to his calf, and shining spurs below, of bright gold, on silk bands enriched with stripes. And so the knight rides with slippers on his feet. And all that he was wearing was indeed pure verdure, which means a greenery, but the crossbars of his belt and the shining stones set resplendent here and there in his gleaming garments, all around him and his saddle in silk embroidery. It would be too hard to tell half of the details that were there in fine stitches, with birds and butterflies, and a high green radiance with gold running through it. The tassels of the horse's trappings and the handsome crupper, the studs on the enamel bit and all of the other metal, and the stirrups that he stood in were of the same color, and his saddle, bow, also in the rest of the fastenings, it all kept glimmering and glinting with green stones. The horse that he was riding, resplendent with the same hue as all the rest, a green horse, hard to handle, a strong steed, huge and massive, tossing the embroidered bridle, the right horse for that knight to have. How splendid he looked, this knight in the green apparel, and his horse's hair was as lovely as his own. Fair waving locks tumbled around his shoulders, a beard big as a bush flowing over his breast, and the full length of the noble hair of his head had been cut in a circle above his elbows, so that his arms were half hidden under it, as by the tunic that covers a king's neck. The mane of that mighty horse looked much like that, its curls well combed and caught into many knots, with gold cord wound around the bright green, for every strand of hair another gold. His tail and his forelocks were inwound the same way, and both were bound with a band of bright green, and precious stones adorning them to the tip of his tail, then laced up tightly in a twirled knot. There many bright shining bells of fine gold were ringing. No knight rides a horse like that anywhere on earth. Never before had one been seen in that hall by anyone. Bright as lightning he shone, so they all said who saw him. It seemed that no man could stand against him. Yet he wore no helmet and no chainmail either, nor any breastplate, nor brassarts on his arms. He had no spear and no shield for thrusting and striking, but in his hand he held a branch of holly. That is greenest of all when the groves are bare. An axe, in the other hand, huge and monstrous, a fearsome battle axe to find words to tell of. The length of its head was at least a yard and a half, the point all hammered out of green, steel, and gold. The blade brightly burnished with a broad edge, shaped for shearing as well as sharp razors. The grim knight gripped the stout handle of the weapon. It was wrapped with iron to the shaft's end, and all engraved with green and graceful designs. A lace was wound around it, fastened at the head, twining in many turns around the handle, with a fringe of fine tassels attached to it, rich embroidery above buttons of bright green. This knight rides straight ahead into the hall, making for the high dais, or the raised platform, undaunted by anything, with no greeting to anyone but his eyes high above them. The first sound from him, "Where," he asked, "is the head of this gathering? I would be glad to set eyes on that knight, and I have something to say to him," end quote from the Green Knight. Over the knights he cast his eye, riding up and down, stopping and looking hard to see who might have most renown. If one studies the culture of the Persian kings, one realizes that the highest title of all, Lord of Lords, King of Kings, was given to Christ, but in parallel, the King of Persia, in the Persian Empire was also called King of Kings, Lord of Lords. And in this high dominion, if a man were to enter into the court of the king unannounced and without humility, or simply unannounced, they were to be killed instantly. This act, in the same fashion, is an insult to the king and a challenge to the king and his dominion. Gawain, the younger and lesser of the knights, was the one that would challenge this green knight. Not for machismo, not for frivolity or game playing, but for the honor of his king in the court. As we further this lecture, we will see that it is the scrutiny put on Gawain, Sir Gawain, and King Arthur, which is comparable to our previous studies concerning Job and his relationship with God the Father, and this the Satan as the scrutinizer of the love between God and Job. Furthermore, we find that the reversal ends the play as well, that God was the one who brought the scrutiny upon Job and the great evil. This is the play that good ultimately was driving the whole thing as cause or prima causa. And it is for this reason that we will focus out of the four cantos, or the four what they call fits in The Green Knight, the poem The Green Knight, Sir Gawain and the Green Knight. We will focus on the moral temptation clause and code of conduct that was bestowed upon Gawain, Sir Gawain, within the court of the king. This is for comparison to our previous lectures once again. As Job had stated to his wife, who had accused Job as well and went against as the Satan, she said, "Why don't you curse God and die, for you have lost everything in the temporal world?" Job said, "Cannot God give and also take away?" God being the giver and the taker away. So this same theme arrives with Gawain, as he said, "I accept the challenge of this green knight to deal the blow, quatso befallis after," which means whatever the consequences. Gawain is not being a fatalist just for the sake of whatever may happen. He is stating this out of a moral conduct or a code of conduct as a knight to his king. This is exactly why he is generated to go do such an act, such as having his own head severed, and is willing to do so. This is not, once again, an act of machismo or fatality, religion or doctrine. This is to serve the king in this fashion. Whatever becomes of me is secondary to the primary thing of keeping the honor of the king to the subject, which is Sir Gawain. As the story continues, we find on Hallows Eve, Sir Gawain leaving for his journey to find the Green Chapel, where the Green Knight will be for the recompense of the beheading of the Green Knight. This journey, this inveiglement of Sir Gawain, or the baffling of the mind for the king's honor, is a trick that was bestowed upon Sir Gawain by, ultimately, Morgiana le Fay, or the Fay or the Fury of Born of the Sea, Mer Si Gan to be born, le Fay, the fairy. In the end of the story, you see that the Fatua, the Fortunae, the witch, the Vitian, was the person or the thing or the fairy behind the scrutiny put on Sir Gawain. As this journey went on from Hallows Eve to Christmas tide, we see that Sir Gawain found a resting home, where the man of the house or manor said and entreated Sir Gawain to stay with them and to watch over his beautiful wife while he went hunting. The offer was, whatever he hunts, he will give to Sir Gawain, and later will require that Sir Gawain hunt and give all that Sir Gawain has hunted to the man of the house. It is within this staying time that Sir Gawain is tempted of the beautiful maiden lady of the house. Here the trial begins. Scrutiny takes place. Sir Gawain, once in the household or manor, was informed that the chapel was only about 2 miles ahead of him, the Green Chapel, that he was to meet the Green Knight. His journey had been long. He only requested that he could go to this chapel. But the entreaty to stay and to rest a little while, and the obligation that they, the people of the household, the fair maiden and the man of the household, would show him or have him shown where the chapel is, only to relax and rest at the manor for a certain time. This begins the contract of courtesy that will be visive for Sir Gawain within this temptation process, for it is the courtesy that we will now see to be under trial. To get to the meat of the matter of this temptation, which was the obvious thing, the man is out of the house, the room, we have the case scenario of temptation where the woman, who ultimately was in on the trick, knew of the courtesy the knight must engage in and was enacted in. And we have a statement from verse 1770 and following this. For that sumptuous princess pressed him so hard, lured him so near to the edge, that he knew he must either give in to her love or rudely refuse it. This rudely has to do with the coarse action that would have taken place against his mannerisms of courtly and knightly conduct. He, Gawain, was concerned for his courtesy, as I have stated, not wanting to be coarse, and still more for the damage it would do if he sinned and betrayed the lord in whose house he was staying, lord being the owner of the manor, not Lord God. But God save me, Gawain said, that will not happen. Lightly, with kind laughter, he turned aside all the seductive talk that leaped from the woman's mouth. The lady said to the knight, it is wrong of you not to love the one you are lying next to, whose heart is more hurt than any in the world. But if you have another love, one dearer, whom you love more, and have given your word to that lady in good faith, and would not want to break it, that is what I believe. Tell me the truth about it now, I beg you. In the name of all the loves in the world, do not hide the truth to be cunning. The knight said, by St. John, which we have allegory that the St. John's day was the beheading day, and this is also the day in respect to the beheading coming forth on Sir Gawain. Very allegorical in the spiritual path, by the way. But anyway, the knight said, by St. John, with a gentle smile, lover have I none, nor will have for a while. That is the worst thing, she said, that you could have told me, but I have had my answer, and it is hard to bear. As you see, the lady is playing on the courtesy call of Sir Gawain. Now kiss me kindly, and I shall be on my way to the sorrowing life of a woman lost to love. With a sigh, she bent down and kissed him tenderly, and then she lets go of him and says, as she stands there, now, my love, as I leave you, do me one kindness. Give me some token of you, your glove or some such thing, to remember you by and comfort me in my longing. Now, I'm going to stop right here a second and show you that the rules of the game are enacted by the woman in the adulterous act. She comes with her a compartment of rules that she plays on the courtesy. The weak point of the knight's code of conduct is not in the moral aspect, it's in the manner aspect. There's nothing wrong with manners as long as it goes with conduct of heaven and heavenly action. And here's the point. Here's the device that's brought out later on, and even now, that it's the manners that have to be dealt with and redefined by man. Should we be mannerful to mankind if mankind can use manners against us and vice us to this earth in the temporal clause? I say no, and the book sees fit to bring this to head later on. It is the manners of how we should handle things, as we see the Latin manus in Greek and Latin, meaning how to handle the thing. We have the word dodecami, to extend the 10 fingers in God's service, not in man's service. We are not to be men pleasers, but God pleasers. But let me continue. But this is the weak aspect of the code of conduct of the nightly round table when it turns for man. Quote from Sir Gawain. Now truly, the man said, I wish I had here whatever thing I prize most to give you for your love, for you have surely deserved many times over more than anything I might have given you, but a token of love would not amount to much. It would afford you no honor now to have a glove to treasure as a gift from Gawain, and I am here on an errand in an unknown land, and have no porters with packs full of precious things, which I regret at this moment, lady, because of your love. Each man can do only so much, and it is no use complaining. Quote, no, most honored knight, she said, of the fair body, though I have nothing from you yet, you should have something from me. And here we go. Let me stop right here. This is a contract that the dispensers of fortunes would take hold of the man to receive the offering. For the offering given of us to the thing of fortune or receiving, one is still reactive of the other. It's still interplay, cause and effect, effect and cause within the temporal bindings, or should I say all things reactionary. Once you bind yourself in any fashion, you are entering into the contract of the temporal clause, as we have stated before in our Logeia series of the Fortunae. Please listen to this. Let me continue. She held out to him a handsome ring wrought of red gold, with a shining stone standing up out of it, its radiant beams like the bright sun. You can be sure it was worth a great fortune, but the knight refused it at once, saying, Before God, lady, I want no gifts at this time. I have none to offer you, and I will take none. She pressed him further, but he would not accept it, swearing upon his honor that he would not have it. And she was sad that he refused it, and finally said, quote, If you will not take my ring because it seems too costly, and you do not want to be so deeply indebted to me, once again, the rules of debt and repayment, tick for tack, legalism, the fortune's vice, if you will, or the Satan's temptation, if you only take of the fruit, you will have wit. Whereas to Christ in Matthew 4, if you bow down to me, I will give you all that's in this world. Tick for tack. Let me continue. I will give you my belt, which may not seem so precious to you. With a flick, she undid a knot fastened at her waist, tied around her tunic under the bright mantle. It was covered with green silk and embroidered with gold, all around the edges and with gold fringes. And with all her graces, she offered that to the knight, urging him to take it, unworthy though it was, but he insisted that he would not, for any reason, except gold or gift, until God had given him the grace to achieve the mission he had followed that far. Here's a spiritual lesson right here. And therefore I beg you not to be offended, but give up your offers, for I can never accept them. I am deeply indebted to you for the graces you have shown me, and will be a true servant to you, whatever season it may be. Quote, Do you refuse this silk now, the lady said then, because it seems such a slight thing in itself? It is true, it is little, and does not look like much, but anyone who knew the powers bound up in it perhaps would hold it in high esteem. For if a man has this green belt fastened around him, As long as it is knotted about his waist, there is no knight under heaven who can cut him down, and there is no cunning on earth that can kill him. This made the knight reflect and went to his heart. It would be a jewel for the jeopardy just ahead of him. When he arrived at the Green Chapel, to be dealt his fate. If it could keep him from being killed, it was a noble device. Well, once again, we have thought process of the temporal world that we would keep our flesh, our temporal state, as being noble. This is where we have moral, how do I say, physical evil and physical good versus spiritual evil and spiritual good, a confusion on Gowan. But it serves its purpose later. Then he waited to hear what else she might say to him, and she pled with him to take the belt, urging it upon him until he accepted it, and she was glad to give it, and begged him for her sake to keep it secret, and never let her lord learn of it, and the knight agreed that no one should know of it, indeed, but the two of them. Whatever might happen, he thanked her warmly with all his heart and thought, and then three times she kissed that brave knight. This will be the last of the temptations that this fair maiden attempts or tries to put on Gowan. His testing is done in terms of sexual immorality. She now gives a device to saving him or giving him his reward as going out or trajecting out of the temporal clause or temptation. Let's further read. On verse 1870. Then she turns from him and leaves him there, since she would have no more pleasure with that man. When she was gone, Gowan puts on his garments. He gets up and arrays himself in noble attire, hides away the love belt the lady had given him, carefully concealing it where he would find it later. Then at once he made his way to the chapel, went to a priest privately and begged him there to lift up his life and teach him to be better, so that his soul would be saved when he saw heaven. There he confessed completely and said what his sins were, the great and the small, and pled for mercy, calling upon the priest to grant him absolution. And the priest absolved him altogether, so he would be clean, though the next dawn revealed the day of judgment. Of course, this has parts of Catholicism in it, which for our purposes matters none, for Catholicism brings both, in my opinion, the fairy or fae world, the magical world, the mythological world, a tie-in between pagan and Christian. Furthermore, this has reference from the 1400s AD all the way back to ancient Welsh culture, a great menu of mythologies. But the higher point is the grace and the moral conduct between man and God, the mannerisms between man and God that are pronounced and preached. This supersedes all other myths or sub-theologies. Let's continue reading in verse 1885. Then he joined the amusements among the court ladies with graceful dances and pleasures of all kinds, and more than any day he had known until the dark night. I believe that he did not fall into sexual immorality here, for his temptation was through. He was happy, and he raised everyone's spirits so that they said they had not seen him since he came there in such a merry mood. Now let him linger in that haven, and love be with him, while the Lord is still out in the field leading his men. Now right here we're going to refer back to this Lord, this man of the manor, or the house, whose maiden tempted Sir Gowan. Like I've stated before, the two trees of Tin and Dor, the holly tree and the oak tree, these are the twin trees. There is a grand allusion, to the actions of temptation and the effect, and from the poetical stance, the figurative stance between the actions of Gawain or Gowan overcoming temptation and the killing of the cunning one, or the Nakash, if you will, the Hebrew serpent movement in the Garden of Eden, as serpent belays to the maiden or the Eve in the garden, and Eve becomes the Lilith as she tempts Adam, Lilith being the goddess of the night or darkness in her cunning. Let's continue. He, the man of the manor, has killed this fox. Now, this fox was a literal fox in the story's sake. Also has allegory to the cunning one, which Gawain obviously overcame the cunning one, the fair maiden of the manor. So back to the verse again, the man of the manor. He has killed this fox that he followed for so long, as he leapt over a thorn hedge, looking for the villain. The thorn hedge, the berries, the hollies. This is part of the tree branch tales. Hearing the hounds that were hard on his heels. This is the spirit of hell itself, if you will. Reynard comes dashing out of a dense thicket, and all the rabble in a rush behind him. The Lord saw the wild creature and waited as was ready, and he draws the bright sword and slashes at the beast, who shies at the stroke and tries to turn back. But a hound is before him and heads him off, and right before the horse's hooves they all fell on him, with a roar of rage, mauling that cunning creature. This is parallel once again to the action of killing off the temptation. The Lord leaps to the ground and seizes him, snatches him right up out of the hound's mouths, holds him high over his head, and with a loud shout, above all the hounds baying at him in fury, the hunters rush toward him, all sounding their horns, rallying the rest until they caught sight of him. Of course, this is allusion to Macbeth as well, being taken by the hounds in Scotland to take him in and to kill him, to persecute him. Then when that noble company was assembled, all who had bugles blew them at once. This is called victory, the victorious trumpet blow. We see this in 1 Thessalonians 4 and 1 Corinthians 15:52 concerning the trumpets of victory, the overcoming of the temptation over evil itself. And the others all shouted who had no horns. It was the merriest uproar that ever man heard. The resounding din they raised, the racket for Reynard's soul. I won't go into the mythology of this, but later we will hit this. They give the hounds their reward, pet them and praise them, and then they take Reynard and strip him his coat from him. And then they start home, for it is nearly night, blowing loudly on their horns as they go. The Lord alights at last, happy to be home, with a fire in the hall and the knight waiting beside it. The good Sir Gawain, who was in high spirits among the ladies and their loving entertainments. He was wearing a rich blue mantle that reached to the ground. His outer cloak, lined with soft fur, suited for him perfectly, and his hood, which was like it hung over his shoulders, both trimmed all around with borders of white fur. He meets this good man in the middle of the floor and greets him and the others and says to him, smiling, I shall begin by fulfilling our agreement that we sealed to suit us both when the drink was not spared. Then he embraces the good knight and kisses him three times as sweetly and as earnestly as he could manage. By Christ, said the other knight, you have done well in the prize you have taken, if the prize was right. Never mind the price, the other said, as long as I paid the earnings I owed. Marry, the other man said, mine is far short of yours, for I have hunted all day and taken nothing but this foul fox pelt, the devil take it. Which is pitiful repayment for such precious things as you have pressed on me so warmly here. Three such good kisses. Enough, said Sir Gawain, I thank you by the rood, the rood is the cross. And how the fox was slain, he told him there as they stood. And of course, this is Christ on the Rudi, or Chris on the Rud, which means the rod, the Staros, versus the Tau, or the Tammuz. This is a good example of what I have mentioned before concerning the cult branch tales of Lucian, where he mentioned of the Rud, or the Staros. The Rud is in the Gothic and Latin for the Christ that was truly crucified, versus the pagan Tau, or Tammuz, the dead God laying on the cross, not resurrecting. Furthermore, verse 19:53, with amusements and minstrelsy, and as much as they could eat, they celebrated as merrily as ever men might, unless they were dunces or hopelessly drunk. With the laughter of ladies and turns of wit, Gawain and the good man were both in high humor. The knight and all of them joined in the merrymaking until it was time for them to separate and for all of them to be off to their own beds. Then this noble knight humbly takes his leave first of the Lord there, thanking him graciously for the lavish visit that I have had here and your courtesy at this high feast. May the high king reward you. I offer myself as one of your own, if that would please you. But as you know, I must be gone by tomorrow, and I ask for a knight to show me, as you promised, the way to the Green Chapel, so that God may let me fulfill my fate there on New Year's Day. Once again, fatalism comes into play. This is a twixt between fatalism, belief, paganism, a Christian knight's conduct, and the split or divide between the conduct of mannerisms and morality, of Christ to man, man to man. We have the devices of interplay here. In good faith, the good man said, with a good will, all that ever I promise you I have ready. At that he assigns a servant to put him on the path and lead him over the hills so that he would have no trouble riding in the woods and finding the right way through the thickets. This lecture will be concluded on Chapter 2, or Volume 2, of this CD series. This is Kyle Jones. Thank you.